So welcome back to, have your attention, welcome back to the session of the Southern Alberta Council on Public Affairs on the global nuclear system and Canada's deadly secret. Before Jim Harding comes back up to the microphone to deal with your questions, I want to announce the topic for next week. It will be corporations, commercialization, and universities. Are they compatible? And the speakers next week will be Professors James Byrne, Andrew Haken, and Ian McKenna. So I think that'll be an interesting and lively session, and I hope you'll attend. I also want to remind you that any of our sessions are listed on our website at www.sacpod.ca. So, and you can also listen to the audio of this session on that website or previous sessions. So do to take a visit to our website. And you can record any comments on our website as well. I also forgot to mention the outset that there is opportunity to sign outside the door to get emailed some papers that Jim has produced on some of the matters that he touched on in his talk today. And so if you want more detail on various aspects of that, please do provide your email address outside the door. I'm going to invite Jim back up to the microphone. Again, the topic is the global nuclear system and Canada's deadly secret. You will need to come up here to ask your question, and please do come to the microphone because that's the only way we can get it recorded on audio. Our audio is right here. Keep your comments brief and get to your question quickly, and be sure to state your name before you answer your question. So no questions from the floor, please. Everyone to the microphone, and it's just one of the requirements of our technology. So, Jim, you're on. We have any questions?
Or I'm off.
I'm Tad Mitri. Thank you, Jim, for coming again. Do it again. My question is quite simple about CANDU. How many CANDUs have we sold? How much money did we make?
Not many, and probably none, if you actually look at the actual incentives and the loan guarantees and stuff. The reason why AACL came to Saskatchewan in the late 80s and the 90s is because they couldn't sell in the foreign market. And the estimate I saw it is that if they were going to be free of the government subsidies to keep them alive, they would have needed one sale a year. They didn't have a sale until the Korean one for 11 years during that period. And the foreign market is totally dried up to their technology. Areva and the American light water companies have got the foreign market. China, if they expand this, it'll clearly be using the light water design. So they came because they had no foreign export market to keep them alive. They came to Saskatchewan, and we said bye-bye, and they're here now for essentially the same reason. They are trying to get their foot back in the market. But they're dead in the water. The joke in Ontario is that AACL is going to end up as a can-do repair service. And that's very likely. The problem with that is that we would have put $21 to $22 billion of taxpayer subsidies into keeping that industry going, which in real terms, in terms of cost of interest and debt, is about $75 billion. And we'll end up with Areva or GE or Westinghouse building the new reactors if they actually go ahead in Ontario. So there's the foreign ownership issue now. And 80% of Canadians in the last surveys I saw believe that if there is going to be an industry, a nuclear industry, it should be Canadian owned. By the way, another 80% don't believe it should be expanded without the nuclear waste problem being resolved, which it hasn't. So Canadians have good common sense on this. We get hoodwinked. when we see things as having a spin-off in a small economy. So, you know, there are going to be contractors who will always support building, especially cement contractors, building nuclear power plants. But their sales have dwindled, and I think there's only 20-some in Canada and maybe that less than that abroad. There's hardly any CANDUs actually on the planet. They might be 30, 35 of the 400 and some nuclear power plants operate.
We never made money.
Oh, absolutely not. You want to talk about money, you know who makes money is Nordion, the company that was privatized by Mulroney and sells nuclear isotopes. They make money, and the ACL people who did the research that led to the nuclear isotope business, which is a multi-million dollar. The Nordion controls 50% of the world nuclear isotope market. The people who are in the public service who did the research, they're really pissed that they didn't get the benefits of those sales.
My name is Tom Kane, and I heard you last night, Jim, and really appreciated your comments, was challenged by them. And in the with the electronic age, I decided, well, that letter that you wrote to Albertans, I'd like to read that before noon today. I signed up to get it sent to me last night on by email, but it hadn't come. So I Googled your paper, and up it came, and it came up who is announcing your paper to Albertans but the Peace River Society of Alberta. The let me get the correct name. The Peace River Environmental Society. And they have Jim's open letter to Albertans and a wonderful website. Very easy to get. It's just Peace River Environmental Society.org. And after I read the paper, I'd like to say thanks for your letter. It's wonderful to challenge us as a neighbor from Saskatchewan. I also appreciate what you said today, that we're the grandfathers and the grandmothers, and that we needed to network, you said last night. So I thought, well, just for the hell of it, I'll call up one of the gals who's running the Peace River Environmental Society this morning, because they had a petition. I don't think petitions get you very far, but it raises awareness if you get somebody to sign their name. So I printed that, and I'll put them out on the table. They're circulating an Alberta petition. So I wanted to know, is there a deadline? So I called her, and she said, no, there's no particular deadline. That's on their agenda to discuss next time when they meet. And they said they're beginning to take your suggestions about networking seriously. They had a gentleman from who used to live in Port Hope, and the question is, he came up from Grand Prairie to Peace River, and he wanted to know, I'd ask his question, how do you get youth involved? So have you had positive suggestions to us about how do we get youth involved, not just us grandparents?
Okay, so thank you for showing me that the person who asks the question can actually take longer than the person who answers it, because I got to catch an airplane. So are there any questions? How do we get youth involved? Youth are already involved. I spoke to high school students in Hamilton in classes on religion and science and biology, and they're so involved they can't open their mouths. They're so overwhelmed by this climate change scenario, which has come at them impersonally without anybody putting their hand on their shoulder and saying, don't worry, you don't have to do this by yourself. We're going to help. You know, and it is really time that this generational thing got, we got this together again, because these kids are in a lot of them in a kind of collective attention deficit state from overstimulation, and not a conversation about that calms us down and says, like, we're going to do this together. So that's the first thing. That's the first thing, is we've got to calm the waters and create some room for conversation across generations. And that means all of us really have to stop judging the other and listen, really listen, because everything that everybody has to say matters. This is the deep democracy part of this. It's called choosing within inclusive diversity. That's the rhetoric, but it's a very important vision. And the kids aren't in the circle that much right now. So Everybody's got to reach out, grandpa, grandma, whatever, and make those connections. And we got lots to learn. We got to listen. It's not about telling or directing. It's about us renegotiating an intergenerational sustainability strategy. And I know my younger son, who's 25 and runs a punk band, said, "Dad, I'm going to take your class." And I said, "Oh, boy, this is going to be interesting." And I said, "Why?" He says, "I want to know what you and Grandpa have been talking about." And I said, "Good." And he took a class from me on ecology and justice. And that was a breakthrough, but he's my third son. The other two, you know, little shy. But the young ones, they've been watching it. The young ones always seem, I'm a young one. The young ones seem to, you know, something's going on here in the family. And the young ones have a particular role to play. Everybody has a role. I thought, this is great. My kid's taking my university class, and he's not self-conscious, and whatever it takes. The PERG groups are great. They're growing all across the country and on the campuses again. Everybody in the community should reach out and do what they can to help the activists on the campus that are doing stuff, because they're the bridge into that generation. So maybe you should have the PERG people speak here. I don't know.
My name is Bob Anderson. You're here and there around the country, just across our border. Have you had opportunity to, is it easy to get, hard to get, to actually talk with politicians and legislators? And if you have made those kind of contacts, I guess my fundamental question is, why don't they believe science?
Well, something's happened in terms of our concept of science. I call it scientism now because I didn't know what to call it. But that would be when the industrial and the corporate sector appropriate those who are considered experts in areas, and then the public assumes that the whole thing knows what it's doing. That would be the scientists in Health Canada and the scientists in AECL, and they're the experts, etc. Well, actually, a lot of them are engineers. Some of them don't even know their basic physics. I mean, I talk and debate with these people. Some of them are just PR people, actually, who write letters countering what some of us say at meetings, and they have no academic background. So it's time sort of to wake up, first of all, that there is a scientific community all across the world that's been looking at the question of the health impacts of low-level radiation. 46 of them just did a review of standards for the European Committee, the European Parliament, and they're the ones who said all our radiation standards are kind of out of whack because we hadn't even discovered DNA when they were set. And the alpha internal emitters are the most toxic. Those are the ones they say, "Don't worry, Jim, your hand can stop it. Put up a piece of paper, but stop breathing too," because it's the inhalation of the alpha emitters that leads to the extreme carcinogenic effect. So they don't listen to the science because the scientists have been marginalized by the nuclear elite since the nuclear weapons system was created. And if you want to get into the detail, the UN-related body, International Agency of Atomic Energy, made a deal with the UN in 1959 that keeps the World Health Organization from doing primary epidemiological research on the health impacts of the nuclear fuel system. So there's a reason why we haven't heard from the WHO on Chernobyl, because they're muzzled by an agreement. So we got to open the doors again. The UN needs house cleaning. The error, the windows must be opened. We got to redemocratize the UN. It did its job. We all should be grateful about the UN Declaration of Rights and the move towards international law and the criminal code. I'm very thankful for my seniors after fascism for creating this institution. We have to do it again. The next generation, we always have to rebuild these things. We've got to let the scientists come in, be heard, etc. The politicians don't want to hear it because it will be viewed as an impediment to short-term economic growth.
Yeah.
My name is Mark Sandilands, and Jim, I heard you last night and again today, and I'm just enormously impressed with your grasp of the whole situation. I think people in the room might think a nuclear plant in Whitecourt or Peace River is sort of an abstract thing way down here in the south, but there is a company working south of Pincher Creek that is looking for low-grade uranium ore in southern Alberta, in the Old Man River watershed. So we need to learn how to organize a body similar to the one that you talked about in Ottawa and your group in Regina. Can you talk a little bit about those things?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's Uranium News, which I think you can just Google Uranium News, and you'll get into the Ottawa Basin Network, and they're doing just an incredible job of culling the papers. In fact, they're my research assistant now, literally, and about 20 other people, because now I don't have to clip. They're the ones who sent the thing saying the Colorado Medical Association has voted unanimously for a ban on uranium mining in the state of Colorado because of aquifer contamination from the old mines. The whole bloody state medical body. So, you know, it is happening, but if we don't know this is happening, we can't become party to this sort of change. So you Google Uranium News and you'll be in the network that is that group, and they're an incredibly good group. And for sure, you've got to get to the Physicians for Global Survival Network to get access to the study from India on the public health consequences, because I think this is going to break open some room. It's been basically suppressed, but now finally somebody's done one. The environmental health thing and the weapons thing matter in every sense of the word in terms of protecting the planet and not allowing the proliferation to occur. And given there are alternative energy systems available and more cost-effective, it seems to me it's the only moral choice, but morality hasn't been doing well lately. Morality and the invasion of Iraq, morality and think about what's been done in the name of morality. So we maybe need a new language, sustainable ethics or environmental ethics. I don't know. We need a new language to talk about this stuff.
Hi, Jim. Henning Mundell is my name. I'm going to ask you for a question on an update. You raised Chernobyl. Okay, the update I want isn't on Chernobyl, but that was about 22 years ago. And at the time, our son was an exchange student in Germany, where there were widespread and immediate, well, very immediate, very next day or two, prohibitions about children being outside in the playgrounds, food that couldn't be eaten and so on consumed. Okay, my son was in Augsburg in southern Germany. There's the Rhine River and the border to France. The fallout didn't reach France. In other words, there were no such... Okay, because of their industry so heavily dependent on nuclear. I just wonder, can you give us an update? Is France's position still similar?
Oh, yeah. No. In fact, Helen Caldicott, in her book, Nuclear's Not the Answer, just, I guess, the year before last, I think refers to this, that if you were in France, you would be totally blinded to what they know happens in Italy or Sweden. There were plutonium hotspots, actually, in Sweden. I took my family there the year after to do networking, and all the time I thought... So we got to do this. We got to stay in touch with people. But Jan and I kept saying, you know, is this the right thing to do, to take our children through Western Europe and Sweden? And we said, we all have to choose to keep building our connections globally. We just have to keep doing this. We can't all go and start hiding. But there's areas where I'd say it's 600 years before they'll be farming because of the iodine and the cesium, because of the half-life. Taken out of commission. The statement by the industry that only 50 people died and stuff is total trash. if you, but they've done a reasonably good job of protecting North America from knowing the fallout. But if you go to the epidemiologists in the Ukraine and stuff, they're dealing with a incredible thyroid cancer epidemic among children and a lot of immune problems, apparently. And we can all guess, but the radioactivity is actually not yet peaked in the water system, the main river system in the Ukraine. And I got that from their radiological, their environmental branch. We've got to do research to find out what is happening. I've heard 300,000 to 400,000 already in some fashion, life-shortened or, you know, but we're playing numbers games here because no one's systematically studying it. Three Mile Island, by the way, same thing. Do you know who funded the follow-up study of Three Mile Island? The insurance companies that covered the liability of the industry. And what did they do? It's garbage in, garbage out. If you put low-risk estimates in, calculated on false epidemiological data, and then you put low-dose data in, you get certain results. But that's just a theoretical game. At some point, you've actually got to do the study, right, that looks at people who got high doses to people who didn't get doses and then do some comparison. So the science still hasn't been done. And the nuclear industry is not different than the smoking industry or the vinyl chloride industry or the benzene industry or the mercury industry or the asbestos industry. We know those have all been environmental carcinogens. And it's the same story in all these cases. And read Deborah Davis's new book. She's an environmental oncologist. The Secret History of the War on Cancer. And you'll get this whole history of the manipulation of research on environmental carcinogens because of political economic interest.
We're rapidly running out of time. As I say, we have to be done at 20 after. We have three questioners. Those are the last three questions. And I ask you to keep your questions brief. And Jim, if you could keep your answers brief so we can get through everyone. Thank you.
My name is Van Christu. Thank you so much, Jim, for enlightening us on a number of matters today. You pointed out that this audience, that there's quite a bit of white hair in around the room. And how many students are there here from the college or the university? Would you put your hands up, anyone from the college or university, students?
They're in class.
Not one. And the point I want to make is that I've been associated from close and from a distance with education for some years, and my observation has been that there hasn't been an effective rally at a university on any matter of importance over the last 25 years in North America. Have we been so marginalized? Have we been so fascist-oriented? Have we been turned into a fascist state where students are afraid to speak anymore?
Well, I mean, there's fear. I was telling people last night, the PERG group in Regina came to our farm for a retreat to find a way that the old board and the new board could get their story together so they could sort of build up some understanding. And when we were doing one of the social therapy, human development exercises that I try to do to open things up. And so in other words, to bring what's in the unconscious out into the discussion. My son at one point stood up, and I always learn about my kid through these processes more than I do directly. He stood up, and this is a musical chairs game, whereas if the others agree with what you're saying, they change chairs. He stood up and he said, since I became involved in organizing PERG, which then had to go to a vote to the students, I've had dreams of being tortured. Everybody moved. Every one of those students. And it's Guantanamo Bay, and it's rendition, and it's all this fear of someone's going to take you in the night. We debriefed that one. Because he touched a nerve. I didn't know Dagan felt that way. So fear and suppression is real. And it's us. It's us. I'm serious. It's the older people now who've got to create safe places where people can feel it is safe to talk about their full being. It's not about politics or just decision-making now. Okay, it's a bigger circle we have to form. And I think that the leadership has to come from all of us. But fear is quite widespread.
My name's Dwayne Pendergast, Jim. Thank you very much for that. I'm going to go straight home, and I'm going to call all my friends in Lake Ontario that drink that tritium-polluted water to see if any of them will answer the phone. On a more serious note, though, my hobby horse has been greenhouse gas emissions for several years now, and I've personally conducted a life cycle assessment of emissions from various sources. And I find that the CO2 emissions from nuclear are actually even lower than from wind or solar energy, and far below the emissions from coal, which you suggested as a reference. So I'm wondering where you get your information, and maybe I could recommend you take a look at my website and look at some more objective studies.
No, that's fair. I appreciate that. The SEDATA Institute in the Netherlands is a good source. They're doing some quite thorough full cycle analysis. The New Economics Foundation, which is in the name telling you that they realize we have to start looking at economics differently. Read Heat, the book Heat. Got the pages referenced where he looks at the latest research and comes to the same conclusion. I'm still trying to get the CNA to send me the study that every letter to the editor that they write challenging the assertion refers to. I know it was done by the Japanese electric utility company that runs the nuclear power plants. Okay, they commissioned it. And that's their reference in every public document to justify their promotions that it's clean. But they haven't sent it to me yet. And I really want to see how the method was done to look at it carefully. But I admit a bias. I am skeptical of industry-funded research. So I want to see whether they did a fair comparison. They make exactly the same assertion you do, that there's less than there is from wind and solar. So I trust the CEDATA, C-E-E-D-A-T-A, Institute in the Netherlands, the New Economic Foundation, the work that Monabit did in Heat, and I am waiting for the study that the Canadian Nuclear Association uses as justification for its ads, and haven't yet received it.
My name is Lawrence Hoy, and I have not been working in the nuclear industry, but I am a promoter of it in a certain sense. By the way, Cigar Lake, the water has been stopped from an old drill hole. The water has been pumped out, and my understanding is that, in fact, the miners are back underground. So you're wrong on that one. There was a study done recently in Great Britain, and it counters your German study because, in fact, they looked at these islets of high concentrations of leukemia and so on amongst children close to nuclear power plants. This was a blue ribbon panel from many, many of the outstanding universities they have over there, and they completely debunked the whole business of the power plants causing the problem. My question to you, if you're so hard on nuclear power, why aren't you hard on the coal-fired plants, which spew out far more radioactive materials than a nuclear power plant? In fact, the big Sundance plant up near Edmonton about 2,000 megawatts, probably churns out maybe 4 or 5 tons of uranium every year.
The Cigar Lake mine, if they have it pumped out, that's good, I guess, but the reason why low-grade uranium is being explored is because that's not going to get onto the market in time to meet their contracts. The dispute about the German study, it was done at the University of Mainz, has been accepted by the federal German Ministry of Radiation Protection and a number of scientists who reviewed the biostatistics. Where the controversy is not about the findings, but how one possibly can explain it, considering what the official position is about the risk of cancer from low levels of radiation. The dispute now is, are we even aware of the actual levels of emission? Are these being measured reliably? Are our risk estimates accurate in terms of the low levels? And the answer to that would be no. In so many words, the findings are forcing all of the assumptions in the regulatory and the radiobiology to be re-questioned. That's how science advances, by the way. So I think either you have misinformation or you're talking about something totally different. The reviewers of that study said it was an immaculate and the best biostatistical study. The main biostatistician is not a radiation epidemiologist. So he's saying, this doesn't make sense in terms of what people tell me are the risk relationships. So now the debate will continue. Everybody is saying it's the parsimonious explanation, okay, proximity. The last question about uranium and coal, well, I don't know. This was used in Ontario. They went to the Environment Ministry in Ontario when Cameco said as much was coming from coal. The Environment Ministry said that's balderdash. It's probably about one-tenth. And yes, there is natural uranium in coal. We know that. So that's a good reason to shut down coal and the nuclear industry.
Well, on that note, join me in thanking Jim, and I'm sorry we have to close it so quickly. I'm sure we could go on for a long time, but I have to whisk him away. So don't even stop him on the way to the door. He's got a 2 o'clock day.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jim.